Hello, and welcome to Real Talk on 101.9 FM and on voiceofvashon.org at your convenience. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, and today we have a Real Talk special broadcast for Wednesday, May 4th, 2022. Our award-winning Vashon Theater family, the Walcotts, are always generous with their screen, and that generosity invites even Hollywood royalty, like screenwriter Robin Swycord, to premiere their films here. Well, this week, Vashonian cinephiles get a special free treat with a premiere screening of Double Down, Wednesday night, May 4th, 7 p.m. at the Vashon Theater. To whet your appetite for this new movie, I'm delighted to have with me the film's producer, Rick Wallace, and writer-director, Tom Schulman. Welcome, Rick and Tom. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for having us. We appreciate it.
Well, this is pretty exciting, and I have to start with the obvious question. You two are Hollywood heavy hitters. Why are you screening your film here on Little Vashon?
Well, that came as a kind of confluence of events. We had screened twice in Hollywood, so the people who were watching the film were either in the business or were at least Hollywood adjacent. And we were thinking about what we might do in order to screen to a non-Hollywood audience. And my next-door neighbor and very close friend, Jan Nielsen, lived on Vashon for 47 years, though I've never been there. He's spoken highly and regularly about it. And he suggested, because he knows Eileen Walcott, that theater might be a good place for it. Tom has two very dear friends, Robin Swycord, who you mentioned already, and her husband, Nick Kazan, who have lived there for 30 or 35 years. And both parties, and Tom and his family, have been there many times. So it was just a coming together of possibilities, and we ended up gratefully on Vashon.
Well, Rick Wallace, since you've never been here, you are going to join us on Wednesday night in the theater, correct?
Oh, yes, I will be there with bells on.
And you too are going to be here as well, Tom Schulman.
Oh, yeah. And I'm looking forward to Rick being initiated to the ferry and so forth. But yes.
Yeah, start early.
I can't wait to get there. Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard that. Yeah.
So tell us, gentlemen, what it is you would like to get from this Vashon audience?
We would just love to see how the audience responds to the film. You know, in Hollywood, there was an old tradition of taking movies out of town to preview. And in the old days, in the 30s and 40s, all the executives and filmmakers would get in some cars and drive down to San Diego, which at the time maybe had, you know, a couple of 100,000 people at most, and they'd screen the movies, and then, you know, if the movie did well, there'd be a celebration, and if it did poorly, they'd be in their cars fighting on the way coming back up. So we're hoping that we're going to have you know, the former, not the latter, but we would love to see how the movie plays to, as Rick mentioned, sort of non-Hollywood people.
And although this film is not for children, there is no nudity in the film. There is some violence, and there is language, and so it's not a film for children, but we would like to have as wide a cross-section of audience as possible in terms of demographics, and so being able to speak to you is wonderfully important.
Well, also in these days, you know, we are now, you don't often, movies don't play in theaters that much anymore. You know, it's, if you're lucky, your movie gets released to the theaters for a few weeks, and then it goes into, you know, onto a streaming service, and it's essentially on people's televisions for the rest of its existence. So I think for us, just the pleasure of watching a movie with an audience is something we look forward to.
Yeah, that is pretty exciting. It's exciting for us that the theater has reopened and we can watch movies on the big screen. And I hope that the Walcotts are having greater success with the films that they're showing. But that is a question I have for you who are producing movies in this day and age because of the pandemic and because of the the rise of streaming. How do you write a script and produce a movie that is going to fit on both a large screen and a small screen? What do you have to do to adjust to that?
Very, very good question.
Yeah.
What's your answer? I mean,
we have no answer. No, the answer is you have to think. First of all, the good news is a lot of people have some large screens in their living rooms now. You know, so it's not on a Motorola, 12-inch. But although people do watch movies on their iPads and on their cell phones, so just have to adjust to that. It's led to a trend of sort of more close-ups and tighter shots, that basically just adjusting to the home screen environment. But there's a happy medium, and we hope we struck that with the way we did this. We shot this film, what they call anamorphic. It's a 2.4:1 ratio of length to height. So which is something that's become more common on Netflix and other streaming services, and that gives you a sense of both the presence of the movie in your home and also a television experience at the same time. There's been a lot of thought about that, and so that's we shot it that way for that reason, and also because there are pool tables in the movie, and that ratio allows us to see the whole pool table in the frame.
Oh, that's interesting. So you're kind of going for a combination of intimacy and span, if you will. Is that?
Yes, exactly.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm. So my
in a frame, I'm sorry, in a frame that wide, you can put more details into a frame than you would with the other kind of shots.
Well, and I wonder about editing too. There was an editing trend, I think before the pandemic, that was really tight and fast. How has that changed, if at all?
I think it's really what suits the material, and it, what there are places in our movie where there was more suspense and danger. In those cases, you might be editing with a faster pattern. There are other places where it's dialogue, and you want to sort of savor what's going on between the characters. So it's slower. Really depends on the material, I think.
It also depends to some extent on the medium. Television tends to shoot faster rhythms because largely or partially because people have the ability to go out and get a snack, and television wants to hold them there for as long as possible during commercial breaks when there are commercials. So
You've apparently done more television, Rick, than you have film. At least that's what our little blurb told me.
Yes,
is that true?
Yeah.
So my understanding is this film, Double Down, which we're going to see Wednesday night at the Vashon Theater, is in post-production. Would you explain to our listeners what post-production actually means?
After you edit, finish shooting the film, post-production involves editing the movie, involves having a composer put music on the movie, and we have not done that yet. So what the Vashon audience will see is a temporary music track. We think it's good, but it won't be as full and good as the final one. The sound that you get on during production usually needs cleaning up. And we've done some of that in the edit, but you hire a sound house to come in and put in sounds that you didn't get when you were shooting, and take sounds out that you don't want, and that sort of thing. And the color and the lighting of scenes to scenes don't necessarily match as well as they will when the colorist gets involved and they adjust all the shots to match each other. So that's another part of post-production. And then you mix all the sound together and you have your final product.
It's really a complicated art form. Rick, you had something to say to add to that?
I would say that when a film is shot, there are 100 hours of film, let's say. And so the editor is going to get that bulk of material. and has to cut it down to length. In our case, the length is around 2 hours. And then the process entails, as Tom said, marrying dialogue, sound, music, and all elements as to the picture, which has also been color corrected and made to have conformity, more or less. So it's a huge process. And so from those 100 hours, we're down to 2 hours, and we're very eager for the audience to feel what the audience, the response is to that material.
So given all that, how long, or can you even predict how long it will be before we actually see the finished product?
We're hoping to finish the movie in late June, and we'll probably be submitting it to festivals. We're hoping it would arrive at some festivals in early September. And then depending on how it's distributed, it might be in it really just depends on the distribution.
Yeah, that's a whole different process, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So would you call this an indie film?
Definitely.
Yes, and something that the audience might like to know about the film is, and Tom, maybe you'll elaborate on this, we consider it to be a woman's empowerment film.
Ooh.
And can you talk about that a little bit, Tom?
Sure. It sort of gets into the content of the movie, but when I grew up in Nashville, and when I was part of my misspent youth was at a pool hall called 20th Century Pool Hall in downtown Nashville that was a dive. And it's kind of too dangerous. My parents were always telling me, don't go to that pool hall, but I did. And there was a game played over at one of the corner tables called Keno. And not to be confused with the game, the gambling game in Las Vegas. But Keno pool involves putting a very thin, flat board on the pool table. It occupies about a quarter of the table's length and all of the table's width. And there are holes drilled on the board for each hole in the rack. And in the middle of the board is a double hole. So the person who's playing, and it's a big gambling game. In fact, it was outlawed in 17 states during its heyday.
Wow.
The game, we think, began somewhere in the early 1900s, and it died out somewhere in the early 2000s. So the person who's breaking can, if they win on the break, they get to play again. The other person doesn't get to shoot. So let's say you're betting $5, and if the person on the break makes a double on the break, you owe them $10. And then they break again. And if they double again, now you owe them $20. And now if they miss, it's your turn. But you should know that if you shoot and miss, they get to start again. And you could end up losing way more money than you have in your pocket. And in that corner of the room, there was a woman who came to play every so often. She came alone. And she would seem to be as tough as the guys that played that game. And as a young boy, I would watch her, you know, just hoping she would pay some attention to me, which, of course, she didn't. And but she was a hell of a Keno player. And I sort of filed that away in my brain and always wanted to do something with that story. And about a year and a half ago, I woke up and went, I know what that story is. And so that's this movie.
Wow. And it's billed as the dangerous and shady world of Keno. Who knew?
That's right.
Keno. So it sounds to me also like, since this story is placed at, I think you said, the early 21st century, is this kind of when the whole game of Keno was losing popularity, transitioning out of popularity?
I think that it died probably around 2005, 2007. I think it's high stakes poker that probably, you know, put the stake in it, in Keno's heart. Just to add to the story a little bit, I have a friend whose brother, after high school, opened a all night poker game in his living room, and he moved out of Nashville to a nearby county. He got a federal gambling license so he could pay taxes on what he made, and he paid off the county police, And he basically had one or two sometimes poker games running in his house 24/7, and he would just cut the pot. His family lived upstairs. He ended up making enough money to send his kids to private school. And he would lure great poker players from all over the country to come to this poker parlor. And then the locals would come and try their luck against him. So these attractions that he brought in were money-making ideas that he had. And that's kind of what's going on in this movie. The Kim Coates character, Nick, is bringing big keno players to this place out in the woods, where in the rural Georgia, and has a similar arrangement that my friend's brother did with the police, and is making money, taking a percentage of the winnings, or if he backs somebody, taking a very high percentage of the winnings. So that's the environment of the movie.
Ooh, and I'm starting to hear the tension or the conflict. Can you say a little bit more about the woman empowerment part of this?
Yes. I mean, to me, it started as a challenge in a way, because my wife said to me, boy, you know, you've written all these male-oriented movies, and, you know, in some movies you don't even have, you know, more than one woman. So do something about that. And I had this idea about this woman. So, you know, I decided to try to, because it's such a dangerous world, it's a man's world, it just seemed like a really good place to challenge a character and see what she could do. And so that's, Lily Simmons plays that character. She's, you know, there's another woman in this house, with this Kino parlor house, but she's the one that's charged with sort of going in there and seeing if she can get out alive, basically.
Boy, this sounds like fun. Sounds fascinating. And fast-paced? Is it fast-paced?
In places. It you know, it takes a while to set up the whole, you know, I think the audience has to learn about Kino. The audience has to learn about, and she does too. So but yes, it gets, it's sort of a snowball going down the hill. Starts slowly, goes faster and faster.
So I'd like to introduce our audience to the two of you just a little bit more. Each of you have been pretty successful in the world of Hollywood, which isn't easy. Rick Wallace, can you tell us some of the shows that you have produced?
Yes. The shows that I think the audience would be familiar with that I produced were L.A. Law, which I did for 8 years, and The Closer, which I did for many years, which was clearly a woman's empowerment piece.
I really liked that show. Yes.
With Kira Sedgwick.
Yes.
Then that spun off into Major Crimes with Mary McDonnell. And others, but those are the two that I think the audience would be most familiar with. I also did Women's Murder Club, More Women.
What about Hill Street Blues? Didn't you? You did it.
I did.
Skin on that, didn't you?
Well, yes, but I directed Hill Street. I didn't produce it. And I worked extensively with Stephen Bochco, who did Hill Street Blues, mm-hmm. L.A. Law, NYPD Blue, and many others. And so
a lot of crime dramas.
I did primarily crime and legal dramas.
Yeah, some also of my favorites.
Thanks.
How does that tendency of yours influence this movie in any way? Does it?
Well, I think, to be totally honest, it really has to do more with rising action within the film. And certainly television crime and legal drama relies on I could call it rising action, but the consequences becoming greater and greater as the piece progresses. And so from an aesthetic point of view, I don't see that much difference between this film and the shows that I did in terms of I guess, structure and content. It's drama seems to work that way.
Interesting.
At least in my
very
brain.
Very interesting. Does. You're listening to a Real Talk special on Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington, and at voiceofvashon.org. I'm Susan McCabe, your host, and I'm here delighted to be speaking with Rick Wallace, producer, and Tom Schulman, writer-director of a film that you're going to be able to see free at the Vashon Theater Wednesday night, May 4th. Tom Schulman, tell us about some of the projects you've been associated with.
I've been a writer most of my Hollywood career. I wrote Dead Poets Society, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, What About Bob, Welcome to Mooseport, Eight Heads in a Duffel Bag, Medicine Man, Holy Man.
Great stuff.
I may be forgetting something. I also directed Eight Heads in a Duffel Bag. So, and I produced Indecent Proposal and Me, Myself, and Irene. Or executive produced.
Wow. That's humbling. And I know it's not easy. Rick Wallace kind of alluded to this notion, and that is that everybody who works in Hollywood has written, produced, directed, made a whole bunch of movies that we probably haven't heard about. Would that be true? And how true is it?
It's a tough one. You know, the Writers Guild registers between 20 and 30,000 scripts a year.
Yikes.
And that's been true for decades. And I only know this from the movie side. But back in the days when they were registering 20,000 movie scripts and 250 got made. So, you know, the odds were not good. So and a lot of people make really good movies that somehow don't get recognized. And that's a shame. And I think the good news about streaming and what's going on with TV is that those movies are now available for people to discover. So hopefully some of the injustice of that or disparity is going to get evened out over time.
Well, and I hear and I read that there is a trend toward people of color, their scripts, sure. Their productions, yes. Their
long overdue.
Yeah.
Same with women, women writer, women directors. You know, in the 20s, all the writer, the not all, but most of the heavy hitter writers were women. And so when talkies came in, they started looking for playwrights, and most of the playwrights in New York were men. So once that started a trend of importing playwrights to Hollywood and pushed women out of the picture for a long time, way too long. So if you look at the origins of the Writers Guild, most of the people on the board were women to start. So it's nowhere near what it should be yet. I think the guild does studies. I think women are still only 25 or 30% of produced TV and film, but that's up from 12% a few years ago.
Yeah, that's so a pretty major change in the landscape, I would say.
Yeah, and it's going to change the taste of the audience, which is good. Same with diversity. You know, people are finally getting a chance to see what people with diverse stories, you know, those kinds of stories, and audiences are responding. So it's great.
How, if at all, would you say those trends have changed the characters that we see in film and TV?
Seems to me that they're more complex, you know, than they used to be. And I think because of the way TV is now sort of serializing shows, where they're, you know, the audiences are willing to watch sort of long stories, as opposed to just every week is a different episode with the same characters, which is great. But there's another side of things too, things like Ozark and that kind of show, where you're watching a very long 3, 4, 5, however many season story. And that gives the characters some time to breathe. And we were talking earlier about television versus film and the pace of things. If you watch Ozark, which is a very popular show, mm-hmm. you'll see the pace of that show is very slow compared to what, you know, network television was. And that gives the characters, us as an audience, a chance to really look deeper into the minds and psyches of those characters.
Rick, yeah, what do you have to say about that? Yeah.
As a historical note, when Hill Street Blues in 1980 premiered, all of the shows that, particularly shows of that genre, but also shows that were legal shows, were all procedural. There were no relationships between the characters and whatever their home life might have been. And Stephen Bochco and Michael Kozel changed that with Hill Street Blues. It was a huge change in what television was about, because all of a sudden you saw the home life of the cops, for instance, on Hill Street Blues. And the best episodes were always when whatever was going on in the precinct or on the streets impacted what was going on in the characters' lives. And so that was an explosion in television, and it changed the face of television. I was fortunate enough to be there and witness it and be a part of it, and it was huge. Even today, if you talk about the Law and Orders, they are procedural. Very rarely do you get even a glimpse into what any of those characters' personal lives are, and that's Dick Wolf's philosophy of television filmmaking. He doesn't want to go in that direction, and no one can question his success. That's for sure.
That is for sure. But it's really interesting that you describe that, that we fans, we audience members begin to identify with the characters. And I think, I would guess, that makes us loyal to the serialized shows that are streaming now, where we become involved with these characters and with their lives, and that's an incredible hook.
Well, you know, a lot of shows will do that, but then the network or the studio, if they're studio network shows, insist on what they call standalones. That is to say, even though a show is serialized, they want to believe that something begins and ends in each episode. Well, that doesn't happen on all television. I mean, if you're watching Game of Thrones, for example, it's a journey, or Breaking Bad, or many of the more popular shows. It's a journey. And I'm very grateful that we've expanded what we're capable of in storytelling terms.
It is the golden age of television, as they say. Does it make it harder to write a script when you're stretching out a story like that, when you're evolving characters as you go? Does it make it tougher, or is it more interesting?
I think it's more interesting. I mean, I'm still in the world of features, and worked on a couple of TV shows, and working on one now with a couple of friends. But you know, you're suddenly discussing, well, what's going to happen 20 episodes from now? How's this first season going to end, and where is it going to go in the next season and the season after that? And you know, how are these relationships between the characters and them with their friends and families going to evolve and play into the larger story? It's fascinating. It's more novelistic. It's, you know, from a writer's perspective, I think it's more challenging, but also more satisfying, because you really do get to go deeper and not constantly have to serve as a plot. So it's good for writing.
Yeah, I've often thought I'd like to be a fly on the wall in the writer's room for some of these shows, just to, for that conversation. How did they come up with that? How did they get that idea? In the last minute that we have, I'm sorry to report, what would you like audiences to take away from Double Down, the movie that you will be showing this Wednesday night, May 4th, 7 p.m. at the Vashon Theater?
That's a good question. For me, that's hard to do without giving away the third act and ending. So But I hope to some extent, I hope they have a good time, but sorry, this cat is just, they have a good time, and they also are moved by the journey of the main character.
Rick?
And what she has to accomplish.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I hope that the audience leaves the theater feeling really good about the experience that they've just had. And I expect that for a large portion of them, they will have that feeling that you have when you go to a movie and you say, wow, that was good. It was uplifting. That's what I hope they leave the theater with.
And dear listeners, I want you to know that you will be able to talk with writer-director Tom Schulman and producer Rick Wallace after the film about just what you did take away from it. Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Rick, for joining me here on Real Talk.
Thank you, Susan. We really appreciate you.
Absolutely.
Thank you, dear listener, for the time you've spent with us.